Maine CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah answers your questions about COVID-19. The new year starts with new hope that the end of the COVID-19 pandemic may be within sight. Maine has already vaccinated thousands of frontline healthcare workers and is beginning to administer the vaccine at nursing homes. But the vaccine rollout has not gone as smoothly as hoped. Many people remain confused about when they will know it's their turn, how they'll receive their vaccine, and whether it will prevent transmission of COVID-19. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Maine CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah will bring us the latest on the deployment of the COVID vaccines in Maine and information about the new mutated strain of the virus. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm your host, Jennifer Rooks. We start the new year with the person everyone wants to hear from, Maine CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah. We'll discuss Maine's vaccine rollout and the latest information about COVID-19. What questions do you have for Dr. Shah? You can send an email, a brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. And as always, if you can keep the email or tweet or even the call brief, that's always the best case, but especially when Dr. Shah is on our program, because so many questions are coming in. Dr. Shah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good morning and Happy New Year, Jennifer.
Happy New Year to you. What are the numbers today, the first Monday of the new year?
Well, as we go into this first Monday in the beginning of the year, Maine CDC has recorded a total of 25,968 total cases of COVID-19. That is an increase of 378 cases since yesterday. Right now in Maine, there are 186 people in the hospital, 51 of whom are in the ICU, and over 1,100 who have been hospitalized cumulatively. Those numbers are sad, and they are unfortunate. There is a new number, however, that we are starting to track since the last time I spoke with everybody, which is the number of folks who have been vaccinated. As of that morning, as of this morning in Maine, that number now stands at 33,425 people who have received a dose of the COVID-19 vaccination.
Well, that leads into my next question, which is really a much broader question. As we head into the new year, and as you talk about this number, more than 33,000 vaccinated so far, but also learning about things like a mutation of the virus, I'm wondering, Dr. Shah, from your perspective, what are you feeling about the new year? Hopeful, apprehensive, something else?
To my nature, at my core, a hopeful and optimistic person. And this year gives me more reasons for hope and optimism than at any point than last year. There are, even though we have, again, at a place where we are still seeing several hundred cases per day and over 150, now 180 hospitalizations, we have achieved a degree of a high plateau with those. But there is the chance that will go up based on whether this new mutation arrives in the United States, it has already, and then when it makes its way to the Northeast. We're prepared for that. But the pace of vaccination, the possibility of new vaccines being on the horizon, all of those things give me hope that at some point this year, we'll start being able to bend the curve of the COVID-19 pandemic across the state. It's going to take work. It's going to take all of us continuing to make those sacrifices we've made all throughout 2020, but I've got reasons for hope and optimism there.
All right. Well, that's nice to hear from you. I'm sure everybody is holding on to your every word there, paying attention to every word. We're talking about the mutation of the virus, and for those who have not been following this, this is something that was first detected in England. I understand that public health experts believe this new mutation of the virus is more easily transmissible than the COVID-19 virus we've been used to this past year. And I'm wondering, I have a few questions about that, Dr. Shah, and the first is, If this is more transmissible, does this mean that things such as face coverings will be less effective?
The answer there is no. Face coverings will be just as important if or when this new mutation arrives in the Northeast and in Maine. The reason that this virus seems to be more transmissible is one of two reasons. One is that it may congregate in higher concentrations in our nasal passages, which when we cough or sneeze are the ways that the virus propels from one person to another. And those higher concentrations may just expel more of the virus. That's one reason. The other reason that it might be more transmissible is that once the virus gets in your body, it's better able to invade our cells and take over our body's machinery to reproduce. Both of those seem to be playing a role. But masking and physical distancing will be just as important as ever. No matter how much virus there is in your nasal passages or how effectively it can commandeer your cells, if you block it from going anywhere by a mask, or if you're more than 6 feet away, or even 8 feet, depending on how far the virus can travel, none of those other features of the virus make a difference. If the virus never gets in your system, it doesn't matter how well it can commandeer your body. So face coverings, physical distancing will be just as important in 2021 as they were in 2020, this new mutation notwithstanding.
And you also have said now twice, if or when it arrives in the Northeast or in Maine, which leads me to conclude that you don't believe it's in the Northeast now. I understand that it's been found in Colorado, California, and Florida. I also understand that the CDC is now looking at 3,000 samples a week to see if this mutation has shown up. Are any of those samples going to the CDC, the genomic that they're testing for the genomic sequence, are any of these coming from Maine and have they come back negative?
So yes, many of those samples are from Maine. Yes, they have all been negative for this mutation to date. On top of the samples that we send to the U.S. CDC in Atlanta, we have separately, ever since the beginning of the pandemic, been working with our colleagues and partners at the Jackson Laboratories to work with them to sequence the samples that we also have here in Maine. So we've been keeping an eye out, not just for this mutation, but any kind of mutation, because that's what good science is about. We've always got our antenna up. Thus far in Maine, we have not detected evidence of this specific UK South Africa mutation. However, given the way that viruses do what they do, which is spread, especially if a virus can spread more quickly than a counterpart virus, I think the way that we should all be thinking about this mutation is, again, not whether it will come to Maine, but rather when it will come to Maine. Now, I know that sounds scary. Indeed, when you talk about things like a pandemic, and then you already, on top of high anxiety, introduce the word mutation into that, let's just be honest. It presses all the scary buttons. I understand that. What we know about this mutation is that even though it spreads more easily and maybe it can take over someone's body because of the way that viruses do what they do, it also doesn't seem on an individual level to result in any more severe COVID cases. So people who get this new variant are just as likely to, say, for example, have to be hospitalized. That's based on early data. The vaccine seems to be effective based on the scientists that have briefed us from Moderna and Pfizer. That being said, anything that happens more commonly, even if it has the same rate of bad things happening, like hospitalizations, if it happens 50 or 60% more commonly, hospitalizations and deaths could also go up.
All right. Let me ask you, when we talked a couple weeks after the Thanksgiving holiday, we were seeing an alarming surge. We're now, a week and a half, almost 2 weeks since Christmas. What kind of impact are we seeing from that holiday season, the December, the Hanukkah, Christmas, New Year's holiday season?
Well, in order for us to really see the after effects of large congregate holidays like Thanksgiving and the holidays of last week, we usually like to look out about 10 days. So we are starting to get into that period where if there were to be an increase of cases associated with the holidays of last week and the week before, we would start seeing it in the next coming days and probably on a sustained basis for a week to 10 days from here on out. So as of right now, what we are seeing is the events that occurred, you know, about 2 weeks ago, the transmission events that maybe occurred in the run-up to Hanukkah and Christmas. It's still going to take us at minimum 3 or 4 more days before we see any possibility of transmission that may have occurred, say, in people's houses during those holidays.
All right. Let's talk about the vaccines. Good. You mentioned 33,000 people already vaccinated in Maine. I know many of them are frontline healthcare workers. It's been fun to watch the Facebook posts. Many doctors and nurses I know posting pictures of themselves getting vaccinated. There are reports that Maine has actually gotten more vaccine per capita than other states, yet it still is, isn't it, Dr. Shaw, fewer than expected. How is our pace of vaccination distribution right now, and what do you expect next week and the week after?
Sure. So, you know, as I speak, people across the state of Maine are being vaccinated. And that is after the year that we all collectively had. That is one of the reasons that I've got hope and optimism for this upcoming year. Now, our pace of vaccination has focused, or our vaccine approach has focused on two goals: vaccinating with velocity and vaccinating with equity. And we've tried to prioritize both of those goals. I am thus far, based on where we are now, starting the fourth week of vaccination, very proud of the way that Maine, the state of Maine, Maine CDC, has worked with hospital partners, healthcare providers, clinics, to start the process of vaccinating folks. Our approach to who we vaccinate has been to start with a small nucleus of folks within hospitals that regularly interact with and care for COVID patients, ICU personnel, EMS clinicians, and then moving outward from that in concentric circles. Right now, for example, this week, we're starting to vaccinate outpatient providers, folks that you may go see, say, in your primary care clinic. And then after that, we'll move out another concentric circle. Our goal is to be, again, able to vaccinate healthcare providers and then start thinking about others across the economy, those who work in critical infrastructure, those who are of a certain age. Vaccination is a difficult process, and it is going to take time. We are doing everything we can on our end to speed that up as much as we can. But at the same time, right now, for example, we are constrained by the number of doses we get every single week. We hope and anticipate and have been told that those numbers of doses will start to increase, but thus far they haven't. And as soon as they start increasing, we can ramp up and turn up the dial on how quickly we vaccinate folks.
I think a lot of people understand the way this is being rolled out, at least in principle, the concept of healthcare workers first, and then those over a certain age second, and those with underlying conditions. But the question is a lot in the logistics. I think a lot of people are sitting at home and saying, how will I know? How will I know when it's my turn, and where do I go? How, Dr. Shaw, will people be contacted when it's their turn to get a vaccine?
That's a great question. I know that it's been on the mind of my mother, for example, about how is she going to know exactly when her turn is up? And it really does depend on who you are. So if you are, say, for example, someone over a certain age, it's likely that the way you may find out that your time to be vaccinated is ready is perhaps from your physician's office, because we're going to be working with doctor's offices and outpatient clinics across the state to make the vaccine available. It's also possible if you happen to work, for example, in a frontline occupation, that you may find out from your employer that the employer is working with us to provide on-site vaccination. So it will depend on where you are and which of those various categories that you fall into, which of those concentric circles you happen to be in, and that will kind of govern how you find out that your number in line is ready for vaccination. It won't be the same for everybody, and right now, although we are really focused on those healthcare providers still, because we still have a long way to go just before we get through healthcare providers, which I think will take us the balance of this month, we are starting to work with other providers to start vaccinating older folks, folks who are on the front line.
Sure. And by other providers, I know that includes pharmacies. The grocery store chain Hannaford put out a news release last week. Will it come to some point where when somebody goes to, say, their CVS or their Hannaford, that they will say, I am in the category currently being vaccinated, and just either, you know, show their driver's license for their age or show some proof that they have an underlying condition and receive it right there and then?
That is a plan that we are working on. Many of us are already familiar with going to the pharmacy to get our flu shots. That's where I got my flu shot this year. So we want to use places that folks are already familiar with to tap into that familiarity to make it as easy as possible to access vaccinations. And as you noted, that's a place, those types of locations, be it Walgreens, CVS, Hannaford's, or Walmart, are already used to working with people to get their insurance card or whatever needs to happen to register them in order to get into line for vaccination. But the other thing we've got to think about is if we want to get all of Maine vaccinated by a certain date, whatever that date may be, how many vaccines do we need to be doing in our state? How many shots in arms do we need to be doing every single week? And when you start looking at those projections, the numbers are staggering. And we need to be doing, in some models, tens of thousands of shots per week. And one of the things that my team and I are working on is to say, okay, all told, what can all the pharmacies and all the doctor's offices and all the hospitals do? And if that doesn't get us to that number that we need to be at, then what do we need to do at the state to set up additional sites where folks can come in large numbers, thousands per day, perhaps, across the state, and get vaccinated in that manner?
So are you foreseeing or planning for or even hoping for a scenario, for example, where there are big drive-through vaccination lines, people going to places like the Cumberland County Civic Center to receive vaccinations?
Well, I hope there aren't big lines. I'm hoping we are able to schedule things where some of the scenes that people may have seen over the weekend on the news of hundreds of people crowded into a dense line waiting vaccination, I'm hoping that we don't recreate those here, because in a mass vaccination scenario, the last thing we want to do is to crowd a bunch of people into a place where they could cause an outbreak. Wouldn't that be the surest way to undercut that confidence in the process, is if you started having outbreaks at vaccination centers? But the answer to your question is we're looking at every single option on the table to maximize the throughput of folks who can get vaccinated. The sooner we can get folks vaccinated across the state, the sooner we can get on that path to returning toward normal. And maybe that will look like a mass vaccination site, hopefully without the bedlam that we saw in some other states with massive lines of people waiting hours on end and sleeping in their cars. That's not what I want to see here. I want to see orderly, large-scale vaccination where folks can wait, have a time appointed that they are already know when they can show up, and be able to go through that process quickly without any risk of exposure.
And Dr. Shaw, as we start vaccinating people who live in nursing homes, I'm wondering if you're seeing much vaccine resistance as there are is in other states. Are there people in nursing homes refusing to receive the vaccine?
We have not seen that in widespread fashion. A governor of a Midwestern state a few days ago reported that in his state, there had been declination rates of 50%. I'm pleased to say that in Maine, although some folks have said not quite yet, we have not had large numbers of people who have said absolutely not. What we've seen is a lot of folks who have said, you know, I may not want to be the first person in line, but maybe I'm comfortable being the second person in line. We've also had a number of staff members at nursing homes who have said, you know, I'd rather get the residents vaccinated first rather than me. So that type of altruism has also shown through. The bigger point, Jennifer, is what you mentioned, which is, although I talked a moment ago about folks in the hospitals and EMS clinicians being among the first group that we started, the other group that we started vaccinating were residents and staff of long-term care facilities across Maine. As everyone is aware, nursing homes across the state have borne a significant brunt of COVID-19 over the year, both in terms of cases and, sadly, in terms of deaths. We've started vaccinating them, and thankfully the uptake has been good.
All right. Well, we are speaking with Maine CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah. We're going to take a quick break and then get to some of your questions. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bull Moose, celebrating the tactile experience of reading and proponents of dog ears and bookmarks. Locations across Maine and at bullmoose.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent and a practicing neurosurgeon, talks about his new book, Keep Sharp. It explains some of the latest brain research, debunks myths about the brain, and offers practical advice on improving your brain function and resilience. We'll also talk about covering COVID for CNN. Join us.
Coming up tonight at 8 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Thank you, James from Appleton, for donating your 2007 Toyota Highlander Hybrid to Maine Public. Do you have a hybrid or electric car that you're planning to replace? Please consider donating it to Maine Public. It's easy and there's no cost to you. Visit mainepublic.org for all the details. Donated cars, trucks, and SUVs make it possible for us to do more here at your public radio station.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Maine CDC Director Nirav Shah is with me today to talk about the latest pandemic outlook and answers to your questions. If you want to ask a question, send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Dr. Shah, I'll start with an email from Michelle. She asks, if a person has the virus and is asymptomatic, gets a vaccine, can they still transmit the virus to others?
The answer is that it's possible. Now, we don't have a lot of data because, for the most part, folks who were taking part in the clinical trials, the tens of thousands of people across the country, across the globe, who have taken part in the clinical trials, were regularly screened for the virus. So we don't really have great data. So the best that we know, and this question has come up and it's been discussed by the U.S. CDC, is that if someone happens to get vaccinated and they happen to have the virus and they happen not to have symptoms, the vaccine will still be effective. It won't be for nothing. But there may be a time period during which they can still transmit the virus. That brings up a bigger point, Jennifer, which is that even after folks get the vaccine, the things that we've become accustomed to, like wearing face coverings and maintaining physical distance, will still be important to do. Getting the vaccine does not mean that you can chuck your face mask in the wastebasket or no longer need to be maintaining physical distance. Those things will still be important for reasons we can discuss, but the vaccine will definitely be a help, but it's not going to be something that extinguishes the pandemic overnight.
All right. We'll go to William, who's calling from Machias. Hi, William. Go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Jennifer. And Dr. Shah, I really want to thank you for and your staff for keeping us so well informed in Maine. My question is, I'm a long-term AIDS survivor. I have been on disability since a PML infection more than 12 years ago and subsequently with DVTs. Yet my understanding is that prioritization for after we do all the first rounds of the vaccination, smokers and obesity trumps HIV infection. Can that possibly be true? And can you address the HIV population in Maine to reassure us that you do have us in mind and the complexity of this viral disease, living with it for over 30 years, it puts us in pretty anxious places.
Well, William, I'm glad you raised that. And I can certainly understand and empathize with the anxiety that you're feeling. When we talk about chronic or the conditions that may make someone at higher risk for COVID-19, among them are being immunocompromised. So having being HIV positive, as you've been contending with now for decades, and congratulations on keeping things at bay, that would be among the conditions. However, the final way that we think about that will come from an expert advisory panel that the U.S. CDC works with and convenes. This is an expert group of vaccine specialists, infectious disease experts, immunologists, and others who really will make the final recommendations for states for what constitutes a chronic or serious medical condition when it comes time to COVID vaccination. They've produced some draft lists, which I think is what you're referring to. But the final word on that is still something that that expert panel is working through. And as a result of that, we in Maine have not made any final determinations yet either. I'm waiting to see what their expert analysis shows so that my team and I can review it and then do what's best for Maine. But make no mistake, the experience that you've gone through, given that the ways that HIV weakens the immune system, is certainly something that we keep in mind as we think about these things.
And Dr. Shaw, when do you expect to get that guidance from the expert panel?
The U.S. CDC, I know, has been discussing and reviewing this. I don't know exactly when they will put forth or promulgate, as they say, that official guidance of what constitutes a chronic medical condition or a serious medical condition. I know what they've talked about is still somewhat in draft form. I'm anticipating within the next several weeks, if not several months, because that phase of vaccination, what has been somewhat inartfully dubbed phase 1C, is still somewhat several weeks away.
All right, William, thank you so much for your call and good luck to you. Here's an email from Mick. I'd like to hear Dr. Shaw address the conspiracy rumor that hospitals are exaggerating the number of COVID cases because they get $4,000 per COVID patient from the federal government.
Yes, that is an unfortunate, insidious, and flatly wrong rumor that has been circulated by individuals among different precincts across the country. I can say with certainty that no part of that is true. No healthcare provider that I know or have ever known would wish to increase the numbers in such a fashion for so many reasons. One of which is that well, let's just start with the root of this, that hospitals, for some reason, get more money if they incorrectly diagnose or list someone as having COVID. It's just not true. If an individual is less well, if they require more intensive care, then hospitals are compensated accordingly. But the notion that there is some systematic approach on the part of hospitals to routinely and in a widespread fashion overinflate the numbers, I'm going to be honest, Jennifer, it's beyond conspiracy. It is just a systematic disregard and disrespect for every single healthcare provider who has been working tireless hours for the past year. And no one should give it any more credit.
All right. We'll go to Meredith calling from Westbrook. Hi, Meredith. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. And Dr. Shaw, I just want to tell you what an incredible public service you're doing for us. And we really appreciate all the time and effort you and your team are putting in to keeping us safe.
Well, thank you.
And so in March of this past year, we pulled my 88-year-old mom out of the independent assisted living facility that she was in. And we moved up here, my husband and myself, to take care of her. We're staying in a long-term stay hotel until this thing is over. But because we're not residents of Maine, where will that put us with regard to trying to get a vaccination? You know, since we don't have driver's licenses or an address here in Maine, but we're ostensibly here until the end of this pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great question. It's one my team and I have we've started to think about. I don't have an answer for you right now, to be square with you, because one of the things that we're also contending with are folks who are residents of Maine, but who may, for example, be in another state right now for a few months until it warms up a little bit. How should we think about those? I've actually had some conversations with counterparts of mine where our states happen to find ourselves in that pattern where we have a certain percentage of seasonal residents. In Maine's case, given that we're starting vaccinations right now, we have a sizable number of residents who are residents of our state, but who for a few months more may be in another state. I'm not sure if I've got an answer for you right now. The hope, however, is that at some point in the very near future, and I don't know when that will be, but at some point in the near future, the supply of vaccines across the country is such that these distinctions of whether you're a resident of this state or a resident of another state won't really matter, because we will be awash in vaccination to where we won't have to worry about such things. Are we there right now today? Unfortunately not. Vaccines remain a precious commodity today, but hopefully at some point in the future, there will be a sufficient number of vaccines authorized, and they will be produced in large enough numbers to where we won't have to make those distinctions. The only thing we'll care about is vaccinating folks so the entire country can get back to normal.
Dr. Shah, do you have any sense of when that day will come, when we are awash in vaccinations?
We don't really have a sense right now, and that's for a few reasons. Number one is, although there have only been two vaccines that are authorized, there are additional vaccines in the research and development pipeline. Folks may have heard about one that was developed in partnership between AstraZeneca and Oxford University that's received authorization in the UK. There are also a number of other vaccines that are working their way through the research pipeline. Which of those becomes successful, that's going to partly govern which how much vaccine we've got. The other is, how much vaccine can the manufacturers produce? That's really the other question. Making a vaccine is very difficult, very technical. And so those are the two factors that will ultimately govern how much vaccine supply we have in the country. The more we've got, the more that we can make supply greater than demand, the more the questions that the caller noted will go away. I don't have a sense of when that will be, as much as I wish I did.
All right, Merida, thank you for your question. We'll go to Camden and Sally. Hi, Sally. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for taking my call and all the great work you're doing, Dr. Shah. I have two questions, sort of unrelated. One is, when we speak of vaccinating primary healthcare staff, are we also talking about the people who support that staff, for example, custodians and those who clean and care for the facilities in which people are being cared for? And then my second question is, I've heard in the past that source materials for vaccines or certain medicines, for example, penicillin, come from foreign countries, for example, China, if I am correct. And I'm just curious if you could speak to the source materials, where they're from for these vaccines specific for COVID. Are they garnered within the United States, or are we reliant on other countries for those materials?
Sure. Thank you. Yep. Thank you for that question. Both of those questions, Sally. They're great questions. Let me start with the first one. Your question there was whether those who support the work that gets done in hospitals and clinics, such as custodial staff, whether they are part of who we are vaccinating. And the answer is an absolute, unequivocal, enthusiastic yes. My concept of who is vaccinated as part of this first wave is whether you are directly taking care of patients or whether you could come into contact with patients or infectious material that could transmit COVID to you. And the staff that you mentioned, dietary personnel, custodial personnel, are absolutely exposed to either patients as well as the materials that could give them COVID, and they are definitely being offered vaccine as part of this initial wave now. No question about it. They are just as vital to our healthcare system as are the other professionals in those systems. Now, with respect to your second question about where the materials that are being used to create these vaccines come from, the answer is they come from all around the globe. I don't think that there is a single place that manufactures all of the materials. They are highly distributed. Part of that is deliberate. And there are two potential concerns that you could raise from your question. One is a security concern, meaning what happens if the countries that are manufacturing those materials decide that they don't want to give those to the U.S. to manufacture our vaccines? That's a concern. I know it's one that federal authorities and officials have thought about. There is another concern that I think may be generated by your question, which is, is, how do we trust those materials? And there, I can put your mind at ease, Sally. The materials that are used to make these vaccines go through an innumerable number of quality controls and checks to make sure that what they contain is exactly what they are supposed to, nothing more, nothing less. I do not have any concerns on that front from where the materials come from. I would gladly take either of the two vaccines that have been authorized in the United States without hesitation.
Sally, thanks for your questions. I'm going to go here to an email from Sherry. Being a 74-year-old woman living alone and having been isolating since February, I'd like to know if after I get the vaccine, I can mingle with my also elderly vaccinated friends who have also been isolating. We stay at home, going only to doctor's appointments and grocery stores. After the second shot, can we interact in one another's houses?
Sherry, the answer here is that I hope so. Now, the reason I say I hope rather than an unequivocal yes is as follows, and I kind of referenced this a moment ago. One of the open scientific questions around the vaccine is whether it reduces your body's likelihood of even having the virus around. The two vaccines that we have, we know reduce your likelihood of getting clinical COVID, getting actually sick, having pneumonia, needing to be going to the hospital. We know the vaccines work for that. But there's an open question about whether the vaccines eliminate or reduce your likelihood of just even having the virus around you or in your body. If the answer to that is yes, that really opens the doors for the type of socializing that I know that you are craving, that my own mother is craving. But if the answer to that is no, and the vaccine still means that there's still some virus around, well, there's still the possibility you could transmit it. I think it's a little too early to know, but I know that studies are going on to get a better handle on that, and I believe that by the time you get the vaccine, around that time we'll have a better answer, provided that you and all your friends get vaccinated and you're still wearing a mask and you're still somewhat distant apart. I'm hopeful that you'll be able to get together with your friends really soon.
All right. Well, we are going to take another quick break. We're speaking with Dr. Nirav Shah of the Maine CDC. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from St. Lawrence Arts in Portland, expressing solidarity with Maine's arts community during this challenging time. StLawrenceArts.com by Eastern Basements, a division of Maine-owned Eastern Mold Remediation, offering basement waterproofing solutions, EasternBasements.com, and First Pier, specializing in Shopify and offering strategic retail and e-commerce solutions in Portland and beyond, FirstPier.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley. Sir David Attenborough's new nature series looks at the factors that make Earth a perfect planet for life and calls for more action on climate change.
We know how to fix it. All we have to do is to get onto looking at things internationally and globally instead of nationally and parochially.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Coming up shortly after Maine Calling at 12 noon here on Maine Public Radio.
I'm Marco Werman. Asylum seekers used to be able to wait in the U.S. to have their case heard. Under President Trump, they've had to wait their turn in Mexico, sometimes in danger. Joe Biden promised that on day one he would change that. But what if he can't? An update on the Remain in Mexico program. That's next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on our program, Dr. Nirav Shah, director of the Maine CDC, joins us to talk about the continuing spread of COVID, what we know about the vaccine, and to answer your questions. You can call 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Marty calling from Saco. Hi, Marty. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Shah. I'm a big fan of yours. I think I've seen almost every briefing. I'm calling today, though, to ask about the senior citizen prioritization. This seems to be changing almost daily. I'm 68 and I have cancer. And originally it seemed that anyone 65 or over, anyone with a medical condition was going to be in line after first healthcare providers and congregate living situations. And I'm puzzled as to how the frontline workers got in front of us.
Sure. So, you know, we in Maine generally have used what the U.S. CDC's Expert Advisory Committee have recommended, which is then authorized or signed off on by the U.S. CDC itself. Earlier in the summer, a group of ethicists and other clinicians came up with a framework, but that framework was refined by this U.S. CDC's Advisory Committee after reviewing epidemiological data. And the way that these data break down are basically as follows. The bulk of cases of COVID-19 in Maine have been among individuals who are between 20 and, say, 50 or so. And most of those individuals are on the front lines. They are in some type of frontline occupation, be they working at a grocery store or something of that nature. So that's the reason that frontline workers are of importance is partly because they often have a critical role in our state and our functioning, but also because they are the ones who are at the highest risk of disease. At the same time, we also know that older individuals have suffered greatly. Now, the way that we think we can try to vaccinate everybody is, of course, based on how many vaccines we get. Right now, Maine is only receiving about 17,000 or so vaccines per week at most. If we get to a point where we can increase or we are getting many, many more vaccines per week from the federal government, we can start vaccinating not one or the other, but we can start vaccinating both at once. And if we can make sure we've got a system that can accommodate that high degree of throughput, we won't have to make the difficult choices that you note. I don't mean to suggest that one group is more important than another. They're both important because they each have suffered greatly from COVID.
Marty, thank you for your call and good luck to you. We'll go to Jody calling from Bremen. Hi, Jody. Go ahead.
Hi. I think I have a very similar question. I'm over the age of 65, but I'm not sure where I come in terms of the line, you know, the priority line. So just kind of wondering if you were reassessing that. I think some states are pushing people over 65 work to the front line. So just wondering where we are.
Yep, that's exactly right. And we are assessing that. Now, I think it's important to note that right now where we are on January 4th is that we are still very focused on healthcare personnel, the groups that we mentioned earlier. We've only received enough vaccine in Maine so far for roughly half, or maybe just over half, of healthcare personnel in Maine. So we are still squarely focused on making sure that nurses, EMS clinicians, and others across the state can get vaccinated. But as we are doing that, we're simultaneously discussing where we go next. We haven't made any final decisions about whether, for example, the age cutoff for the next group will be X versus Y. No final decisions have been made on that front, partly because we want to see what the data are, and also we want to see what the supply of vaccine will be. If February is the month when vaccine supplies remain constrained, as they have been in December and still in January, that takes us down one pathway. But if we start seeing increases because of newly authorized vaccines, that takes us down another pathway.
Jody, thanks for your call. An email here from Dee. What training do Maine vaccinators get prior to giving the vaccine?
Sure. In order to be someone who is giving a vaccine in Maine right now, they've got to be a licensed healthcare provider who, under the terms of their license, is already authorized to give vaccinations. So there is no special training course that is needed in order to provide a vaccine, a COVID vaccine, because the way that the vaccine operates and functions and is administered is no different from any other vaccine. That is to say, you put some alcohol swab on someone's arm and you jab in and you push the plunger and then you put a Band-Aid over it. That part is standard for any vaccine. What is different about COVID vaccination, however, is that a small, small number of people have experienced some degree of an allergic reaction. So we have been training and working with the sites that are already offering vaccines, namely hospitals and EMS clinicians, to make sure that they observe people for at least 15, if not 30 minutes, just to make sure that everyone's okay. And thankfully, for the most part, everyone in Maine has been okay, save for a very small handful of folks who needed to just be washed for a couple more minutes.
All right, we have a tweet here from John. If the ideal time to test is 5 days post-exposure and results take a week, why test? Why not just quarantine for the specified 10 days, particularly when asymptomatic? The test results don't take a week anymore, do they, Dr. Shaw?
That's right. So that was the second if that assumption and that conclusion is based upon. Testing times in Maine, I'm pleased to say, relative to the rest of the country, the turnaround time has always been favorable. There have been times of extremely high demand where our laboratory, for example, here in Augusta, may have taken more than 48 hours. But to this day, the time between when a sample is logged and when a sample is reported out by our laboratory is at most 48 hours, most of which are within 24. I happened to hear from someone over the weekend who went to a state-sponsored swab and send site on the morning of one day, and by the morning of the second day, they had already gotten their results. And that is why testing is really critical. It's one reason we expanded testing so much, to try to capture those asymptomatic folks that the tweeter or emailer noted. Because if we can get those folks to isolate before they start spreading COVID around, we can really, really reduce the number of cases.
Okay. And I think his point is, why not just assume you have it in quarantine?
Well, certainly after you get tested. Let me put it this way. If you were worried enough about your status to get tested for COVID, you owe it to everybody to quarantine until you get your test results. If you woke up in this morning and you had a cold and a stiff arm and maybe a little bit of a headache and you think you may have got COVID, you should get tested. You should not hesitate in setting up a test. But you should be inside, not interacting with anybody until you get those test results back.
Here we go. Jesse on Facebook asks, what happens if someone becomes infected with COVID-19 between doses of the vaccine? Do they have to postpone the second dose? Is there data to suggest that they may have a less severe course of the disease?
That is a great question. It's similar to an earlier question. Right now, based on where we are, there aren't enough clinically validated examples of that to draw conclusions. The bottom line is, right now, as with any vaccine, if you have active symptoms of the disease, you show up to get vaccinated and you've got a cough, a fever, and shortness of breath, you're not going to get vaccinated. But if you happen to get infected in between your two doses, number one, there is some hope that that first dose may modulate the course of the disease. We don't know that for sure. But so provided you don't have symptoms, you may go ahead and get that second dose. They won't know that you've got COVID, and there doesn't seem to be any harm from that.
All right, we'll go to Bangor and Jeff. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, Dr. Shaw. It's a great honor to talk to you. I am wondering about things like the schools going back to extracurricular activities, the University of Maine playing out-of-state games. What metric are they using to move forward with? In that, I presume things were postponed to assess the status of the pandemic, and everything seems to have gotten much worse. So I'd like to know your opinion on their moving forward. Whether you think that's a good idea?
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate that question, and thank you for raising it. I can't speak as much to the university piece, but I can say, as to community sports, scholastic sports here in Maine, we have moved forward with making sure that they can resume very controlled types of practices, wearing masks and things of that nature. Part of that is in recognition of the fact that although there have been cases, we recognize that there is a simultaneous benefit to physical activity and the camaraderie that comes from those things. It's a bit of a trade-off, as has everything been associated with the pandemic. And we've heard almost with equal portions folks who can't believe that anyone would even conceive of playing organized sports right now, and others who have said they can't believe that, given everything going on, that we would even contemplate not letting people play, kids play in organized sports. So it has been a very difficult balancing act, but given the precautions and the guardrails that we're hoping will be followed, we think that these types of sporting activities will be something that where the benefits may outweigh the definite risks.
Jeff, thanks for your call. We'll go to Paul, who's calling from Farmington, New Hampshire. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for all of this. What will a vaccination cost if you do not have insurance?
Generally speaking, the answer is zero. That assumes a few things, one of which is, and one of the best courses, that if you don't have insurance, signing up for Medicaid, or in Maine, we call it Maine Care. I'm not sure what it's called in New Hampshire, but the equivalent of that type of insurance, that will help not just with COVID and vaccines, but everything else. But let me say more generally, the vaccine is not one that comes with a fee attached to it itself. Now, some folks, based on where they get vaccinated, their clinic or their hospital may charge an administration fee that gets routed to their insurance. I can't speak for every single situation, but generally speaking, the vaccine itself will not come with any cost or bill associated with it.
Paul, thanks for your question. An email here from Joan. My husband and I are both retired healthcare professionals and would like to volunteer in the vaccine rollout. Is there a volunteer sign up?
The answer is yes. I recommend that everybody go to or Google Maine Response. That is our volunteer site and our volunteer registration system. I have been so overwhelmed with just admiration for the people of Maine who, over the course of the pandemic, have enrolled and signed up in Maine Responds in droves. Months and months ago, when I was really concerned about ventilators, one of the things you need to have someone on ventilation is someone to run the ventilator. And I put out a public plea for folks who were pulmonologists and anesthesiologists to sign up on Maine Responds. And within a day, we had hundreds of doctors who signed up. I would ask the folks who just wrote in and anyone else listening who wants to play a role in our vaccine rollout to sign up via Maine Response. You can denote, for example, what your skill set is, what your background is, and what your level of desire to work on with us would be. We don't know what degree of volunteers versus others we will need, but having you registered and being ready to deploy is the first and best step that everyone can take. And I've just been overwhelmed at the desire and the willingness and the altruism and the spirit of community of Maine people to sign up in that fashion.
An email here from Junelle. How long after being inoculated does it take for the vaccine to work?
Generally speaking, we say that someone is fully vaccinated anywhere from 10 to 14 days after their second dose. It does depend a little bit on which dose and which vaccine, but we're talking basically 2 weeks after that second dose where we consider someone to be fully vaccinated, fully inoculated. That doesn't mean you can chuck your mask away. It doesn't mean that you can go to a rave or disregard physical distancing. Those things will still be important, but it does mean that you can perhaps start resuming some of the activities that perhaps you were reticent to do during 2020 because of the fear of getting COVID.
And that sounds to me, Dr. Shaw, like the message you really want to get through this hour.
That's right. 2021 is going to be the year when we start getting on that path to normalcy. But just because we've got a vaccine and just because we're administering it and just because we're making progress on that front doesn't mean the pandemic is going to disappear overnight. There won't be so much as a bang as much as it will be a slow reduction in cases over the course of this year. But those are the steps to getting us back to normal. I am delighted at the work that our team will continue to be able to do as we move ahead.
Well, thank you so much, as always, for joining us, Dr. Shaw. Nirav Shaw, Director of Maine's Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. You can visit MaineCalling.org for more information about our programs. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.